42 Grand Avenue in Oakland, California. Uhuru!
We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. More than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families.
I wanted more. Pay, but what I've got here today is more than I bargained for. When I walk through that door, I bring home asbestosis and silicosis, prolonged long lifelong disease, and radiation hits the children before they've really been conceived. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. I wanted more than a paycheck, but what I've got here today is more than I bargained for. When I walk through that door, I bring home
asbestosis and silicosis for round long black lung disease, and radiation hits the children before they've really been conceived.
We bring more
than just a little paycheck.
I'm
bringing more than a paycheck.
I'm bringing much more.
You're bringing more than just a little paycheck.
Now workers, listen here, 'cause it's important that you know that whatever job there is, the fear that disease will take its toll. If not disease, then injury, my Lord, maybe fall or not. And if not injury, then stress is going to tie you up in knots. So we take home
more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families.
We bring
more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families.
Bring
asbestosis and silicosis from round, long, black, long disease, and the radiation hits the children before they've really been conceived.
We bring
more than just a little paycheck.
But I don't want no more. Don't accept no more. Don't tell them more. No more.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, or Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond. And today, or this is the month of Black August. It's also the month, this is the month that Marcus Messiah Garvey was born in Jamaica, and we're going to be paying tribute to the red, the black, and the green. In the second half hour, we're going to be speaking with Rupert Charles Lewis, expert on Marcus Messiah Garvey. And in the second hour, we're going to be paying tribute to Black August with members of the Black August Committee, and organizing committee, and that includes Shaka and Kumasi and Naji out of Washington, D.C., and Kumasi and Shaka are out of Oakland and Los Angeles. And I would like to thank O'Malley Ishitella for bringing us on Uhuru Radio, and I would also like to thank Archie Shep for giving us the name Diasporic Music. And we're going to go straight back to the music and give you some Marcia Griffith. This is Marcia Griffith and Dreamland. Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, or Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, and we are speaking to you from Toronto, Canada, and we have been listening to the music of Marcia Griffiths, one of the I-3s, and an artist in her own right. She was one of Bob Marley's backup singers, and also a great solo artist, and she did a song called Dreamland, and we failed to acknowledge the fact that we played Sweet Honey in the Rock, and they did a piece called More Than a Paycheck, which is a great song for the working class. And I was watching, listening to watching a video, and people, a video called A Giant of Black Politics, Marcus Garvey, A Giant of Black Politics, and they had talked about how Marcus Garvey, when he made his tour of the United States, one of the first things he did was to go into a coal mine in Pittsburgh, and then he went to, I guess, Costa Rica and to the other his other world travels. He always went to where the working class was and the peasants were to see the conditions under which they were living in. And this is Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and we're going to be paying tribute to the red, the black, and the green. And that is the flag of African people. And this flag was decided upon in a convention in New York City in 1920, in August of 1920. The red, black, and green was adopted by the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities League. And we're going to play some songs by Gil Scott-Heron, Roy Ayers, and the X-Clan, and come back and talk back with you. This is Gil Scott-Heron, and the liberation song, Red, Black, and Green. We'll be right back.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
Descending from the tribes of Africa, inspired by the great black leader.
Vainglorious, this is protected by the red, the black, and the green. With a key, zoom.
Dynamic, articulate, perceptive, courageous, outspoken.
One man is not a nation, brother builds a clan. Strengthened in the circle creates the better man. The colors, the brothers, the key, the motherland. This calls us to assemble this black band. Red, black, and green. Flowing as a compass, sons and daughters. Knowledge leads the way, so I flow like Nile's waters. African American, rebel of authority, majority. Why I'm so called minority. Sometimes they ask me, why are you the rebel? Is that the way you choose to tame the base in trouble? Yep, brother, don't get deep, that's what they're telling me. Just like a sellout. While society gets stronger and stronger, my race is weaker and weaker. Maybe I can make a difference through a mic and a speaker. So my lyrics flow different than a hip hop bebop. My controller, who turns out to be the pop. Wisdom God-given, exercise upon a rhythm. Power positive and strictly Bible, that's how I'm living. Fortress we established, high so none attacking. Back to the ways of our mathematic blackness. They can't solve, it's something they can't catch. Took respect of our lives, and I'm snatching it back. Power flows in the nation, there is life in the key. Let us all bind together in the red, the black, the green. Younger nation, so they can build the tribes. After and beyond, keep the colors alive. A message through lyrics and beats composed. Bring composure outstanding direct to those who understand what was taken. Xerox and stripped naked. Today's pig shall be tomorrow's bacon. Education brings false words. Why do they teach? Everything that I learned, I had to self-reach. What do you know of a race that's dying hourly? The smartest men on the world lay in the Bowery. Or either trapped or brainwashed on the come up. Kick to the butt. Wake up. Are you some kind of nut? Are you blind? Can't you see what's never seen? We need some unity within the colors of the... Garvey-like brotherhood flows with the vibe. And with the key, the flag is kept alive. The sense of power, native to a different land. Originality, fact that I understand. A black fist, black power, and a black man. X-Clan, take a stand with the upper hand. Gimmick, yo man, I'll catch you, fetch you. Kick my foot and then direct you in the right path. Sucker tash, don't ask me about the aftermath. You do what, don't make me laugh, dummy. I am protected by forces beyond you. Think before you step before the rebels, silly mortal. You wearing mother's tags and you don't know what they mean. All you are concerned with is greedy man's green. Sporting your medallions cause they match it with your outfit. Your posse's wearing it, man, it's so illegit. Without definition, you represent the fraudulent. Blessed with blackness, but now you're just dogging it. Truth for truth and a man for man. Ignorance, take a pause, so we'll all understand. Independence is one thing when unity is stronger. No one to realize oppression lasts longer. I'm just one man who fears for the worst. Cause if we don't take a stand, someone will step first and then.
No justice, no peace. Thutmosis, Osiris, Oasis. Patrice Lumumba, Malcolm X, Marcus Garvey, Sonny Carson, the Black Watch. Sissy.
And you are listening to Uhuru Radio. This is Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, and we were listening to the X-Clan out of New York. They did a piece called Red, Black, and Green, and that was sampled. They sampled Roy Ayers' Red, Black, and Green, and Roy Ayers is out of Los Angeles, California, and he did the Red, Black, and Green. And then we also heard from Gil Scott Heron, and Gil Scott Heron did the Liberation Song, Red, Black, and Green. And Gil Scott Heron is a legendary figure. Some regard him as one of the fathers of hip-hop music, because he's been dealing with the spoken word for so long. And Gil Scott Heron's father, Gil Heron, was a great soccer player in Scotland, and Gil Scott Heron's father was featured in an article in the Ebony magazine back in 1948, I believe, and they referred to Mr. Heron as the Babe Ruth of soccer. And with me on the line is Rupert Charles Lewis, the author of Walter Rodney's Intellectual and Political Thought. And Mr. Lewis is an expert on Marcus Garvey. He will discuss the red, black, and green flag, the use of the press, and Garvey's relevance to this period. And Mr. Lewis is the author of Marcus Garvey, Anti-Colonial Champion, also the author of Garvey, His Work and Impact, and the author and editor of Garvey, Africa, Europe, and Americas, and the Americas, pardon me. And Mr. Lewis, how are you doing?
I'm doing quite well. And you?
Wonderful. Good to have you on. Good to have you on the air, and I've always enjoyed speaking to you about. First of all, I wanted to ask you about the red, the black, and the green. Now, this the flag, the red, the black, and the green flag, was voted on at a convention in New York City at Madison Square Garden. At one of the, well, I guess the first convention that the Universal Negro Improvement Association put together. It was at Madison Square Garden, and there were delegates from all around the world, and people voted for to adopt the red, black, and green. I would like for you to explain, you know, the significance of the red, the black, and the green, and, you know, the significance of that flag.
Yes, the 1920 convention, you correctly stated, adopted the red, black, and green as the flag of the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities League. But prior to that, in July 1918, the Constitution and Book of Laws of the UNIA stated in Section 37, the colors of the UNIA and ACL shall be red, black, and green. It also added, each member of the UNIA and ACL shall wear on his coat or her blouse a button representative of the colors of the organization so as to be distinguished as an active member and to merit the respect and consideration of others. So I would say 1918 would be the starting point, but 1920 at the UNIA convention in Madison Square Gardens, attended by some 25,000 delegates, you get the mass adoption of the red, black, and green. Now, the red, black, and green, the colors, in around 1922, the Reverend Alexander McGuire, in a document he drafted called the Universal Negro Catechism, set out the following: the red is the color of the blood which men must shed for their redemption and liberty. Black is the color of the noble and distinguished race to which we belong. Green is the color of the luxuriant vegetation of our motherland. And one can extend the last point in terms of luxuriant vegetation to include Africa's wealth. That's what the green symbolizes. So this is the official interpretation of the colors. However, you will read Garvey gave an interview in 1920 in the Robert Hill Papers, and it is quoted by Tony Martin in the his book Race Force, where this person, Charles White, who was anti-Garvey and who was an informer for the federal authorities, said Garvey told him in an interview that red showed their sympathy with the red of the world.
right.
So, secondly, green, their sympathy for the Irish in their fight for freedom. Mm-hmm. And black, of course, Africa and people of African descent. So in the 1920 context, Garvey's interpretation was a very radical one. And this is a take on the symbolism. But what it indicates is the solidarity in 1920 that Garvey was identifying and articulating with respect to the radical assault against colonialism, against capitalism, and which was the mood of the time. So to understand the symbolism of the three horizontal bands that you find in the flag, red, black, and green, it's very important to interpret this in the context of the radicalism of the post-World War I 1914-18 period. One important fact we need to bear in mind, 2 million black people, African-Americans, West Indian, and African soldiers participated in World War I. 370,000 of these were African-Americans. France deployed about 600,000. Britain deployed a lot of West Indians. So it is these returning soldiers to Africa, to the Caribbean, to the United States. When you examine some of the delegates to the 1920 convention, you will find that these militants who had been prepared to lay down their lives for Europe and for this notion of democracy were now being mobilized by Garvey to say, you now need to put your lives on the line for your own rights, freedom, and justice. So it is this context within which you get the red, black, and green emerging as the symbol of the new nationalism of the early 20th century of the global Africa and global diaspora of Africa.
Well, Rupert, I wanted to ask you a question about that. When we talk about nationalism, he was talking about red, black, and green for a people and not necessarily one nation state, which made this red, black, and green sort of slightly different from a lot of other flags. I think the anarchist flag, the black flag, had a similar, when I say similar, it wasn't aimed at one particular nation state, but... Mm-hmm. How do you explain the fact that, you know, Garvey's vision was, we were talking about uniting at that time the so-called Negroes or the Africans of the world under this one flag? Do you think that, what is the significance of that?
Well, the one flag for the global Africa and black people has to be seen in the context of Garvey's efforts to deal with what was the empire, that the empires in Africa, French, British, Portuguese, and so on, that controlled Africa and controlled the Caribbean, and the United States, which the African Americans as an oppressed group, an oppressed minority. Therefore, Garvey saw that there was a global problem, and that global problem could not be solved on a national basis. It had to be solved through global mobilization. And this is why there is this symbol that is not for a particular nation state, but it's the call to nationhood. Now, how nationhood has turned out and would necessarily have turned out is that you're going to get a multiplicity of states. And you're going to get also the emergence of civil rights. And if you take the document of the Declaration of Negro Peoples of the World, which is a statement by the delegates as to the agenda that they wanted dealt with, it's a diverse agenda, but it focuses on the conditions that exist where they are, and the need for their civil and democratic liberties to be realized, and for their right to political power, as well as to economic power. So one has to appreciate the context of the early 20th century. And the key question is the denial, in my view, of the subhuman conditions that black people faced and the denial of fundamental civil liberties to which they could express their self-determination. So the flag was a symbol of self-determination. How people would realize that self-determination depended on them. Garvey could not influence that. But what he could influence
right.
was the principle of self-determination.
Okay, now you talked about Bishop McGuire. He was the spiritual leader of the Universal Negro Improvement Association. He was from Antigua.
Chaplain General.
And he was from Antigua, but
yes.
Garvey's economic philosophy, you know, I always talk to a lot of young people, and a lot of young African people try to talk about Garvey, you know, basically being an anti-communist and being not for socialism, but being a capitalist. And you put forth in your book that Garvey was essentially could be characterized as a Fabian socialist, and you talked about the fact that he talked about, I think a corporation could only get about $5 million and an individual $1 to $2 million. And I don't think that Bill Gates and these capitalists would really be happy with Garvey's formulation in terms of how much money they could make. Could you speak about Garvey's position on which economic system Garvey was for?
Well, one would have to go back to that period of preparation prior to the convention in 1920. The preparation included the incorporation of what we now know, what became known as the African Communities League. And the African Communities League was in large respect to enable black people to conduct businesses in a wide range of enterprises, to conduct trade, to conduct electronic, to do manufacture electronic appliances. That is in the document incorporating the African Communities League, to engage in publishing, to develop restaurants, laundries, to engage in real estate. If black people are not involved in this, they are going to be hewers of wood and drawers of water working for other people. Garvey's approach to this question was very pragmatic. How are black people going to support themselves? Continue working cotton picking? Continue working on the plantations? There is a legitimate right to economic self-determination. And this was how the movement saw itself. This is why it developed the trading company, which launched the Black Star Line. So whereas we can look back and compare economic systems and argue to what extent was Garvey capitalist, he was capitalist. There's no two ways about that. He was entrepreneurial. But in the conditions of the 20th century and in the conditions of plantation economies that dominated the Americas, United States, the Caribbean, to think in terms of the development of a economic class that was involved in trading was an advanced revolutionary step. If the question, however, is that, as he said in Philosophy and Opinions, we are going to impose a cap on profits. You don't want people to become exorbitantly wealthy. So he has an idea that is very entrepreneurial, but also imposes some limitations on monopoly capital.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wanted to go on. We're going to take a break in about 5 minutes, but I wanted you to talk about Marcus Garvey's press. Now, I know that Garvey had, you know, the Negro World, which was became a daily at one point. It was also in English, Spanish, and French. And I'd like for you to spend the next couple of minutes before we go to play some Bernie Spear talking about Marcus Garvey's relationship to the press and how successful he was with the black press or the African press.
Well, I think that he was professionally, he was a trained printer, and he was a self-taught journalist, and of course, a master of the spoken word. And when you transcribe Garvey's words or his speeches, they literally become essays, because he had studied the English language, he had studied the great speeches made in that language. He was a voracious reader, and of the press of the day, of the books of the day, and he practiced. And therefore, his main occupation before the UNIA, and even in the years of until the decline in the 1930s, was in publishing. The Negro World is the best-known paper and the official organ of the Universal Negro Improvement Association African Communities League, which functioned from 1918 until the early 1930s. And its early days had extremely good contributors from a wide range of Negro black artists, writers, journalists, and so on. And that had an international outreach. And critical to that international outreach was the role of seamen. The black seamen, the African seamen, were able to take from New York City the Negro World through different destinations of the Americas and Europe and Africa. The Negro World itself was banned in several countries, banned by the French in West Africa, banned for a brief time by the British in the West Indies, and attracted a lot of attention, frustrated in the postal services for those who took out subscriptions in the United States, but a very effective vehicle for the social and political movement that emerged around in the late the second decade of the 20th century. And when you look at the more local newspapers that Garvey edited and published, his Jamaican newspapers after his deportation in late 1927 to Jamaica from Atlanta. The Blackman newspaper, 1929 to 1931, had a focus on what the UNIA activities were, but it also took up issues in the Caribbean, issues in Jamaican politics, and was an effective mouthpiece for the 1929 convention of the UNIA that was held in Kingston, Jamaica. His second newspaper, the New Jamaica, 1932-1933, saw it more taking a local interest in Jamaican politics at the time of the impact of the Great Depression, which had a devastating effect on the Caribbean. And it's also the period when he was successfully elected as a councillor in the Kingston and St. Andrew Corporation, where he served from around 1930 to 1934. So his role as a journalist continued right until his death. He published in London when he migrated to England from Kingston between 1934 and 1939, a monthly magazine, The Black Man, which had a school of African philosophy and a set of lectures that were published in order to develop new leadership that Garvey encouraged to continue the movement and giving stimulus to a new generation. So his the communication skills of Garvey, I would say his main communication skill was the spoken word, his work as an orator. And closely following that is his work as a writer, as a journalist. And his using different forms of expression to persuade people of an agenda that would be in their interest.
You're listening to Uhuru Radio, and this is Diasporic Music. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali. I'm on the line with Rupert Charles Lewis, the author of Walter Rodney's Intellectual and Political Thought. And Brother Rupert, I wanted to take a music break, play some Burning Spear, and come back and conclude this interview, if that's all right with you.
Okay, that's fine by me.
All right, so listen to Winston Rodney, Burning Spears, Marcus Garvey.
Marcus Garvey words come to pass. Marcus Garvey words come to pass. Can't get no food to eat. Can't get no money to spend. Whoa. Can't get no food to eat. Can't get no money to spend. And you, hello. Come, give me one, come. Whoa, let me do what I can. For you and you alone. Whoa, you know the right I can do it now. Shall be spanked with many strides.
You're listening to Uhuru Radio. This is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, or Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond. And I'm on the line with Rupert Lewis, who's speaking to us from his home in Kingston, Jamaica. And Rupert Charles Lewis is the author of Marcus Garvey, Anti-Colonial Champion. And we were talking earlier about Garvey's press work. And in the 60s, we had the Muhammad Speaks newspaper. We also had the Black Panther newspaper, which were very successful. And we had the Burning Spear. And, you know, but Garvey had the, like I said, he had a daily for about 3 years. He also was able to publish in French and Spanish. And I don't think anyone has been able to duplicate Garvey's printed work like they did. However, I'm speaking to you on Uhuru Radio, and Uhuru Radio seems to me, under the leadership of the African People's Socialist Party, has made a major breakthrough in terms of this internet radio. I mean, we can be heard, I guess, anywhere on the World Wide Web, and we would really like for people to send emails to uhururadio.com and let us know, you know, what they think about DJ at uhururadio.com and let us know what they think about this interview. But, Rupert Lewis, I would like to ask you, Garveyism and the impact of Marcus Garvey on the 21st century. I saw a video of you. Well, it's a video that I recommend that everyone get. It's called, or purchase, or how they can get it, their hands on. It's called Marcus Garvey, A Giant of Black Politics. And you point out in this video that Mrs. Garvey, Amy Jacques Garvey, in her, from 1968 until 1973, I think she passed in 1973, she sympathized with Walter Rodney, who had been deported from Jamaica, I think, in 1968. And you talk about how Walter Rodney was carrying out a lot of Garvey's ideas. She felt that Walter Rodney was carrying out many of Garvey's ideas when it came to Africa, African liberation, and the education of the youth. That is Amy Jacques Garvey. Of course, Marcus Garvey was married twice. His first wife was Amy Ashwood Garvey. But could you elaborate on the point about Garvey's relationship to this period, and also Mrs. Garvey's last statements about Walter Rodney?
Well, to take the second part of your question first, Amy Jacques Garvey, in the period of the 1960s, was a woman under a lot of pressure from the government. Her son, Marcus Garvey Jr., was under pressure from the Americans. There's a recent document of the CIA that I got assessing the Black Power movement in the Caribbean. And Marcus Garvey Jr. is one of the people mentioned. So that, don't think that the widow of Marcus Garvey, the widow of a national hero, was herself being suppressed in Jamaica in the late 60s. So denied access to radio for her views to be made known. She was entirely in support of the Black Power movement, entirely in support of Walter Rodney and what he stood for, entirely in support of the new generation's activism. And so the Garvey movement, of which she had been a foremost activist, as having laid the foundation. Because the period after independence was a neo-colonial period and continues to be. And she herself recognized that was not what they had fought and struggled for, and that the struggles need to be deepened. And to the extent that Walter Rodney articulated that vision, she was in support, passionately in support of the Garvey legacy being carried forward in the way that Walter Rodney did. There's another part to your question. Can you remind me of that?
I was talking about Walter Rodney and also Garvey's relationship to what we should be doing in the 21st century around Garveyism. Garveyism.
Yeah, we need to do the relevance. I would say the main thing about the 21st century in terms of Garvey's relevance is his insistence on our capacity to take on the odds that are against us. this, in my view, is the single most important aspect of the legacy. The forms of organization, the agendas will differ because there have been tremendous changes in the 20th century, largely in the last half of the 20th century, which make our political situation different from the one that Garvey faced in the first half of the 20th century. My interpretation of Garvey's legacy is summed up in a quotation he gave that what he tried to do, we want our people to think for themselves. No matter what leaders do, if the people are not actively engaged in rethinking the circumstances in which they find themselves, then you're not going to have a social movement. The premise of the premise and success of Garvey in the early 1920s, not a long period, was the emergence of a strong social movement that had a political expression and that also had a wider vision of its place in the world, that it would not accept that place in the world. So I place a lot of attention on the subjective element in Garvey, on the capability aspect, because for much of our history, we have been regarded as subhumans, and subhumans can't set agendas, don't have capabilities of humans. That period has to be put behind us in terms of the subhuman. But the capability factor is what we need to look at, because the capability is largely in terms of our capacity to influence our economic life, our capacity to develop appropriate and workable governance systems, our capacity to develop humane forms of social living. All of these are the issues which we now face in the 21st century, and they are issues that are part of a wider global agenda. The continuation of racism in different ways and forms. But I don't think you can get one particular solution that is going to fit everywhere. Different people in exhibiting their capability and their capacity to think for themselves will work out in their specific environments what are the appropriate answers. Of course, we're dealing with broader issues of global capitalism, and that also represents a challenge. But one of the things that the Garveys always said, and I heard it from Imagix Garvey, was that the rise of Asia would not only be political, it would also be economic. Imagix Garvey repeat that in the late 60s. The rise of Africa has been political, but it has not been economic. And therein lies our challenge. Lies the challenge. And they understood that issue very well. And this is what we need now to wrap our minds around. Because wherever we are, the economic crisis has hurt us more than it hurts other people. And we have in all our countries, whether in Africa, in North America, in Brazil, in the Caribbean, a huge underclass, a huge marginalized population, a huge population that's criminalized and incarcerated. So these are the challenges that we have to wrap our minds around, not necessarily using the forms that Garvey used, although I think one form that he used, which is relevant to us today, is the form of the global gathering. The technology exists, the communications exist, the transportation exists for us to reconfigure what it means to be Pan-African in the 21st century and to be able to deal as a people with the problems that we have outlined.
All right, Mr. Lewis, Rupert Charles Lewis, I really appreciate this time you spent with us. I would like to invite you back on the Uhuru Radio, if you don't mind that, at another time. And I really appreciate the insight you've given us into the works of Marcus Mosiah Garvey, and I thank you very much.
Well, thanks very much for having me, and a good afternoon to your listeners.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah.
And we had been speaking with Rupert Charles Lewis. And this and is this Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali. I'm getting some feedback on this radio, but we're going to move into the next hour. We're going to be playing blues for Brother George Jackson by Archie Shepp. Listening to Uhuru Radio. This is Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, and you are listening to the music of Archie Shepp. Archie Shepp, who is the man who gave me the concept of Diasporic Music, and Archie Shepp, that's taken from a CD or an album by Archie Shepp called Attica Blues, and that song was called Blues for Brother George Jackson. And Archie Shepp is a Florida born saxophonist. He plays the piano. He's a vocalist. He was a college professor, a Renaissance man who was born in Florida, who really influenced me. And we really appreciate that song and that album. The song is Blues for Brother George Jackson, and the CD or album is called Attica Blues. And we definitely like to get feedback, and if you wanted to email us, the email address is dj@uhururadio.com. The Skype option is simply Uhuru Radio, and if you wanted to make a call or call us, you can call 727-565-1599, and if you're calling from the UK, you can call 020-813-3669. We wanted you to stay tuned. In the last half an hour of Diasporic Music, we're going to be speaking with members of the Black August Organizing Committee, and also a young brother named Najee out of Washington, D.C. We're going to be speaking about Black August. But here on Uhuru Radio, we have a very good list of shows to listen to. You can listen to Omali Ishitella Speaks. You can listen to Africa Live, which is hosted by Nye Binga Zimbabwe, who is doing the teching on this particular show. There's Solidarity, Not Charity. There's also Diasporic Music, which you're listening to now. There's a Church and Revolution by Deacon Christopher Frazier, with Deacon Christopher Frazier, and Uhuru on the Move is on the show. Also, there's a French show with the chairman Omali Ishitella, and it is hosted by Louise Kinshasa, and the newest show, the new hit on the block, Caribbean Forum, comes on Saturday with Ron Bob Simple. Very important show. Our brother from Guyana, and we want you to listen to all of those shows. But right now, we want to bring you some music from the UK and some African from the UK. David Hines, I should give my cousin Ralph Jimmy Hyman some play. He used to work with these brothers, Steel Pulse, and let's listen to George Jackson, a song that was written by Bob Dylan. But this is Steel Pulse and George Jackson.
I mean, my black breaking gang bars, still ready for a cause. Thank you.
Solidarity. like George. Help George.
Black Caucus has many markers throughout the long history of resistance in the Americas. There are more than we could ever recount here, but here are a few that are important and undeniable events that affected other events and indeed had global impact. It was a hot, humid morning in August 1619 when dark-skinned Africans were unloaded from a ship in the English colony of Jamestown in Virginia. They were called indentured servants by the people who purchased their contracts. It is unknown what the Dutch sailors called them. Some 30 years later, they would be called something that millions of other Africans would be called on American shores for the next 200 years, slaves. They were, in fact, captives, chained, stolen captives of a vicious race war against black life by the merchant princes of Europe. For those people who call themselves African Americans, their unique history begins here. Another notable date in the struggle for liberty in the Americas happened on another shore, among people who spoke no English and perhaps no European languages at all. Their freedom struggle, however, would change the course of world history, and before it ended, transform the face of at least two empires. I speak of the valiant people of Haiti, at the time called Saint-Domingue. In the northern reaches of that Caribbean island, in August 1791, Africans, mostly from the Congo, held religious services in the dark of the night. They prayed to their ancient gods of African memory and vowed to fight against every slave owner and overseer in the land. They vowed to not stop until free or dead. It was a sweaty time when the slaves rebelled against their tormentors. It would be 13 long years, but by January 1804, a new and independent nation was born, free of the monstrous transatlantic slave trade. The Haitian Revolution, the first truly successful slave revolution in history, had succeeded. The destruction of the French army by the black and mulatto armies of Toussaint Louverture meant far more than a military or even a political victory. It meant the end of French dreams of an American empire and the loss of the richest colony in the world. It meant Napoleon could not hold the vast mid-American territories called Louisiana. The revolution, therefore, weakened French holds on the Americas and allowed the United States to purchase a prize that would double the new nation's size overnight. All of this began in the dead of night, in August 1791, when slaves planned a revolution. On August 21st, 1831, the explosive rebellion of Nat Turner turned Southern society inside out. Although he has been labeled by traditional, that is, white historians, as a madman, Turner was in fact a deeply religious man who was moved by signs and portents that he saw in the summer sky, compelling him to fight for the freedom of his captive people. Only in a slavocracy would the idea of freedom fighting and resistance seem mad. Some 30 years after Nat Turner's rebellion, the Civil War would deal a death blow to American bondage. If there is a facet of American history that does not go beyond the books and records of yesteryear. It has been the various Seminole American wars that were waged across Florida. There were at least three Seminole U.S. wars, and one of them ended on August 14, 1842. Now, some will ask, what does an Indian American war have to do with Black August? Well, that's because the nature of the Seminoles and the real reasons behind their raging wars with the Americans is hidden beneath the mists of history. The very name Seminole derives from the American Spanish term for escapee, refugee, or runaway. It stems from the term Cimarron, which was used by the Spanish to denote Indian or African runaways from slavery. The English in Jamaica and the Leeward Islands called their runaways Maroons, from the same root word. The Seminoles were once part of the Creek Confederacy, but unlike many of their contemporaries, they forged close and lasting relationships with runaway Africans and habitually refused British and American demands for the return of slaves to white service. The American general who fought in the Seminole Wars, Thomas Jessup, put the question squarely when he declared, quote, "This, you may be assured, is a Negro, not an Indian war," unquote. General Jessup wrote those words because of the hundreds of black warriors fighting on the side of the Seminoles, and because the Seminoles refused to sell men, women, and children who had become their kinfolk. It is noteworthy that of all the Indian wars fought against the Americans, the Seminole Wars cost the most American casualties. August 30th, 1856. When the name of John Brown is evoked, the shadow of Harper's Ferry arises in the mind of the small group of rebels who tried unsuccessfully to seize an American armory and foment rebellion among the slaves. But years before Harper's Ferry, John Brown had waged war against pro-slavery forces in Osawatomie, Kansas, after Missourians had sacked the town of Lawrence, Kansas, some 3 months earlier. The fighting in Kansas led to excited reports about bleeding Kansas. What they were tough, nasty border wars between anti- and pro-slavery forces, each trying to dominate the other. Indeed, Brown was called Osawatomie Brown before Harper's Ferry marked him as a martyr for the sacred cause of freedom. August 11th to 16th, 1965. The fires of Watts, a black community in Los Angeles, California, were marked as for rebellion for the generation of blacks in the 1960s. These rebellions, staged in response to brutal police attacks on people, cost the lives of 34 people and also almost $20 million worth of property damaged or destroyed. August 5th, 1970, the Black Panther Party's Minister of Defense, Huey P. Newton, spent some 4 years in prison before winning his release on $50,000 bail on this date. It marked his physical return to the party, at the time a period of great hope. August 8, 1978, one of the earlier MOVE confrontations. Some 9 MOVE men and women were sent to prison for hundreds of years stemming from a deeply flawed trial. MOVE members continue to fight for the release of their imprisoned comrades. MOVE veterans of the August 8th police assault have been imprisoned for 25 years in dungeons throughout Pennsylvania. They remain rebellious spirits who oppose a repressive status quo. The spirit of Black August moves through centuries of black, Indian, and multicultural resistance. It is an emblem of the spirit of freedom. It is a long smoldering spark of the fire in the hearts of a people, hearts burning and yearning for freedom. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
And you are listening to Uhuru Radio. And this is Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali. And that was the voice of Mumia Abu-Jamal. We also heard from Steel Pulse out of the United Kingdom. They did Uncle George, and they also did George Jackson, the song that was from the pen of Bob Dylan. And August 17, 1995, the state... the American state attempted to execute Mumia Abu-Jamal, and it was a huge turnaround of people who came out all around the world, including people in Toronto, Canada, where I'm currently speaking to you from. and we reversed the execution of Mumia Abu-Jamal. They actually had the audacity to attempt to execute Mumia on Marcus Garvey's birthday in 1995. We're getting ready to go to speak to two brothers out of California and one brother out of Washington, D.C. We're going to be speaking about Black August, the origins of Black August, and a lot of the activities that are taking place around Black August. And we're going to be speaking a lot about George Jackson, his brother Jonathan, and also Katari Golden. But yesterday was the 40th anniversary of the Marion County slavery vote, where Jonathan Jackson and several of his comrades were killed in an attempt to liberate George Jackson, liberate some of George Jackson's comrades. And, you know, when George Jackson was assassinated in 1971, August 21st, they found 100 books in his cell when they found him, and he was very much into studying politics as well as martial arts and so on and so forth. He was also wanting to speak, trying to learn how to speak Swahili. I think he could speak Swahili. He also talked about learning Chinese and Arabic, and talked about wanting to live in Tanzania, if you read his two books. And I was in the library the other day looking for information on George Jackson, and Toronto is a city where there are 5 million human beings. Only one library has a copy of George Jackson's book. Where you can, the reference library, of course, I think has two of his books. We had two books out, Soledad Brother and Blood in My Eye. But I think there's only one library in the whole city of Toronto that has one copy of George Jackson's book. And George Jackson is a man who had a Warner Brothers film. I'm not saying that's such a good thing. And we're going to come off of this line and take a brief musical break and come right back with you.
It was a hard task to take on, to make us all believe the conflict line, rescue us from evil claws. They wanted to achieve avenge, to gain respect, defend ourselves to the end. Patriots of the continent, I give all my confidence. Redemption, where them gone? Where them been? Hey, hey, where them gone? Where them gone? Where them been? Where them gone? Tribute.
Zimbabwe every Sunday at 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. as we discuss issues facing African people around the world from Brooklyn to Brixton, Cameroon to Caracas, here on UhuruRadio.com.
Tune into Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 a.m. on the Uhuru Radio Network. We examine issues that affect Caribbean and Caribbean American nationals, both at home and across the diaspora. If you're not listening to Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, here on the Uhuru Radio Network, then your radio is not on.
Set sail with the Uhuru Movement and the African People's Socialist Party on December 12th through 18th for a seven-day cruise to Key West, Grand Cayman, and Ocho Rios, Jamaica, aboard the luxurious Carnival Freedom cruise ship. Special guests include our very own Chairman Omali Eshetela, leader of the Uhuru Movement, and the very talented Ron Bob Semple, creator of The Spirit of Marcus Garvey, a one-man show in which Semple delivers an uncanny exactness of the legendary Garvey, transporting the onlooker back to the time of the revolutionary spirit that gave birth to the African Socialist International. Cabin prices are from $519 per person. Double occupancy and deposits start as low as $50 today, $250 by July 12th. For more information, please visit our website at uhurulegacycruise.com. That's uhurulegacycruise.com. Book your room today with Tanya's Travel by calling 352-232-2131 or by email at tanyastravel@bellsouth.net. We hope you all can set sail with us on the ship named for our struggle, freedom. Uhuru.
You're listening to Uhuru Radio. This is Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, and we are speaking with Shaka and Kumasi. Kumasi coming out of Los Angeles, and also Shaka's coming out of Oakland. Shaka Atien, and they're representing the Black August Organizing Committee. How are you two gentlemen doing?
Great, fine, thank you.
Now, we are in the midst of celebrating Black August, and it's also the 40th anniversary of the Marion County Slave Rebellion, and we have, we know that both of you were locked down with Comrade George Jackson, and I guess we wanted to get an overview of what is going to be taking place this August 2010.
Okay, well, during the 2010 observance of Black August, I think first, Shaka, can you hear me?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Okay, I think what we first owe to everyone who's been involved from South Africa, the UK, and France, Toronto, Havana, and in all parts throughout the United States, I think we owe all of them, you know, a congratulations, a thanks, a salute, et cetera, for the great job that they've done in getting all the information out and making the global community aware of the fact that in this day and time, inside this country, that people who are political dissidents and live inside these prisons are being persecuted. They're being selected for a selective assassination. They're being indefinitely warehoused, and they're undergoing all different kinds of torture treatment in this country today, and that these things and these practices have to be eradicated, and that in order to do that, we're going to graduate our practices and take formal complaints to some formal legal bodies around the world that operate on a global level. And I'd be glad if Brother Najee in D.C. can get on the line, because he can give up more specific information about a working group on political prisoners and prisoners of war, and a delegation that is going to the Geneva session this year, the Geneva Convention session, okay, where they handle all the rules of conduct on this globe in terms of how civilized people and civilized nations should conduct themselves.
And you're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and I guess Shaka's going to chime in, I presume.
Oh, yeah, I have to also you know, thank and congratulate people all around the world. Japan right now is in the midst of the struggle with Okinawa, you know, and the military bases over there. And one of the main things that they are using for focus is Black Elvis. So it's a concept that needs to spread to the international community. It has to, like Kumasi said, it has to go before the international legal system, not just what's going on here in America, but the world court needs to see this. And what he's talking about with Najee, they're formulating a way of taking that before them. Right now, we're dealing here, especially in California, with a prison system that it runs California, basically. If the governor is out of commission here, then the prison system takes over. And people don't understand that that's the, you know, that's the most powerful union here. Right now, in Pelican Bay, for example, Pelican Bay is the answer to what's going on in Arizona's lockdown situation. Pelican Bay has all of the members of Black August selected and put into pods. And each pod is 8 cells, and you have 1 African in each pod. So you're talking about 28 pods with 1 African apiece in each one. No radio. The communication has been stripped down to the only person that can write to them is their mother or some legal representative. So if I were to send something in there, it would be thrown in the garbage can, and they would get a write-up for that letter coming in. So, you know, those are the things we're trying to deal with.
In terms of you...
Go ahead, Norman.
No, I'm saying that's because if you guys have identified Black August as a gang, and if you two brothers who are, I guess, have been targeted as being leaders of this so-called gang, that would present a problem for them, I guess.
Yes, so-called, yes.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because traditionally during Black August, we've asked people not to forget the people who are inside the prisons. Don't let a wall or a fence separate the members of your community from you permanently, especially since they've got to come back at some point. And rather than allow them to come back angry, embittered, disenchanted, disassociated from the reality of the world in which they came from, keep some connection with them, help soften the blows that they take every day, help prepare them to make a re-entry and to reintegrate themselves into the community in which they came from. In the meantime, we and the movement inside is working on them to change their character from a criminal mentality to a social activist mentality, making them understand by studying their history, studying the contradictions that got them angry, got them caught up in the criminal justice system in the first place, got them in a position where they started leading such desperate lives that they acted like desperados, and they struck out against themselves and everybody else, and then found themselves in these prisons. And that they have to take the steps towards reconciliation. They got to reconcile with themselves. They got to reconcile with people that they have been in bitter battles with. And then they got to reconcile with the community that in some kind of way they was considered an offender against that community and was put in prison. And before they go back, they need to make amends with themselves and the community that they came from. So we're asking members from the community to start reaching out and contacting and communicating with so this process can begin. They have said that this is a continuation of gang activity. It has nothing to do with the African condition in this country, the historical a struggle of black people in this country, which part of that struggle, and the main part of that struggle, is getting ourselves together so that we can go forward in history and eventually move history forward. So they're saying that this is all a byproduct of gang activity, and so not only would they not allow us to communicate with the members of the movement, if I ask you or anybody on your radio station and give out their names and say these are the people that have been in there, they have the same mentality that Mandela and his comrades had in the South African prison, and would you communicate with them? Would you hold on to them and tell them we want to see you come back? You're not a threat to our community as long as you've taken these political steps and this political mindset to reconcile while you're there and then reconcile with us so that you can come back and live amongst us in harmony and be an asset instead of a liability. Well, some people feel like that's not going to aid and abet their job security, and so if they lose us, then they don't have a job to do in those prisons. So what they want to do is keep us coming in there, and they want to keep those who are in there, want to turn anybody else's life around, chained to the floor of the dungeon and isolated so that they can't do that job. And these brothers won't complain, they won't turn back, they stand firm and dedicated, and they hold on. And so we just got to make the public aware of this, and then we've got to fight this at a higher level so that we can eradicate the practice, you know, that allows this to take place on a legal level.
You're listening to Uhuru Radio. This is Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. I'm on the line with Kumasi and Shaka. Shaka's speaking to us from Oakland, California, and Kumasi is in Los Angeles, California. And Black August has definitely made some links recently with some younger people out of Washington, D.C. and Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm hoping that we can get Najee on the line. But it looks like it's been some major breakthroughs, and that the breakthrough with Japan seems to be a major breakthrough as well.
Yes, it is. We had delegations come over here from Japan. They couldn't speak English, so we had to find people here that could translate. And their whole purpose in coming here was to acknowledge Black August and take it back to Japan and Okinawa.
And politically,
people that's taking a lead in this is the attorney that you deal with all the time, Standish Willis.
Out of Chicago, Standish Willis, right.
Okay, well, Kwame Standish Willis, yeah, I think that he is the one that has drawn up the indictment, okay, and instead of being vague and in a roundabout way saying they're doing this and they're doing that, you know, this time, you know, a group of people are coming together that have enough legal ability to cite actual incidents and tell who, what, when, where, and why in detail and be specific about this and put it in a legal document and take it to a legal forum. And so he's one of the people that's taking the lead in this.
Also, Afia Wangaza, who is one of the people that's affiliated with the Uhuru Radio, she's also has a document she's going to be presenting in Geneva. She's based in South Carolina, Greenville, South Carolina. So that's another link in this whole struggle as well.
Yeah, and so what we're doing is working this around the country so that we can further legitimize this, and we have to support and reinforce these documents and the people that have drawn these documents up. When they're ready for us to sign on, then our job is to get as many people who are family members of people in prisons and part of organizations like the Black August, you know, organizing committee, et cetera, and BAPO and whoever around the country, you know, to become part of this and to reinforce this so that they understand that this is not just some fringe group, this is not some quack opportunist approach at trying to get information out or make things seem like it's worse than it really is. You know, with a concerted effort, we will prove that that is what is going on in this country and that there are enough of us aware of it and enough of us to know individuals who we can name, places that we can name where they're at, and people who are carrying out these kind of acts against them. And it's got to be done that way, you know. And so far, there hasn't been any kind of a judicial body anywhere in the world strong enough to bring anybody in this country or bring this country, okay, to justice. But like I keep explaining to people, one thing this country does care about, the leaders of this country, and they always have cared, they didn't care about lives, human lives. They've sacrificed 5 or 6 million people's lives in a battlefield. all right? That doesn't bother them. But what does bother them, and I don't understand why, but it does, and King understood this, the court of public opinion. They don't like getting a bad reputation. They don't want you to pull the covers on them, and that's what we have to do. Same thing. That was King's approach. He knew they was going to beat us, sick dogs on us, spit on us, and wash us down the street with fire hoses. He said, I'm going to make them do it on television.
Yeah.
I'm going to bring this in front of
the
rest of the
world.
So they can't. Yeah, because at the same time, they're demanding that the Koreans give up political prisoners, American political prisoners from North Korea. They're demanding that the Cubans, you know, release political prisoners that they got in Cuba, et cetera, et cetera. They won't talk about the fact that they got political prisoners right here in this country. And they won't even discuss the idea of releasing them. So we have to take this to the rest of the world.
Yeah, that's something else that we are encouraging. America is working on 3 million prisoners right now. And what we're doing is we're encouraging people around the world, countries around the world, to send delegations over here to look and see for themselves what's going on, and encourage this government itself to send delegations from Congress, the Senate, or whoever to go into these prisons and look and see that what is being said is not just a fabrication. Go and see for themselves and document it for themselves.
Yeah, we told them, say, we're asking you to get in contact with the heads of the Bureau of Prisons in this country, to get in contact with whoever's in the White House, whatever White House staff member works in concert with the heads of the Bureau, the director of the Bureau of Prisons, and we're asking somebody to open up an investigation, to do an on-site investigation and see if the allegations that we have brought forth have any validity to them. And then if we don't hear from anybody in the Congressional Black Caucus who we've written a letter to and asked them to open up this kind of an investigation, and we've given them a list of things, of suggestions that we would like to see them follow up on, and we've already insinuated to them that if we couldn't hear anything from anybody in this country, okay, that had authority or connected to any authority at the highest levels in this country that are capable of opening up an investigation and seeing if these things are true, and if they are, correct them. If not, then tell us that, you know, what we've talked about is just wild and crazy and we need to shut up. If we can't get an answer from anybody, then we might as well take it to the rest of the world, because there are human rights commissions within the United Nations organization, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, listening, you're listening to Uhuru Radio. This is Norman Otis Richmond. I'm on the line with Shaka in Oakland and Kumasi in California. We only have a few moments left, and I wanted you guys, you brothers, to address how do you see the fact that we have an African, a black attorney general who has Barbadian roots, Caribbean roots, and we have a president in the white people's house who has Kenyan roots, and you know, we have black faces in high places. How do you see that in terms of the question of political prisoners, or does that matter?
It doesn't matter. Look, this is a country based on Roman policy. Okay, who's ever in what position has to follow that policy, or they're not in that position anymore. They pick the people that they know will follow that policy. If these people who are in these positions will not come down off that mountain and deal with what's going on down here in the streets, then they are no importance to us whatsoever.
How do you see it, Kumasi?
Well, he put it about as plain as you can put it. You're talking about a system that operates on its own. Just like a computer, you can open it up, but you still got to follow the first several rules. You've got to sign in. You got to give your code. A computer won't even open up to you unless you follow the first three or four principles of operation. So anybody
right.
that goes in the office, the first thing they got to do is swear to uphold that office. You understand what I'm saying? They got to go by all the rules and the regulations, and they have to follow the dictates of that particular office. So if the dictates of that particular office will assign you to the role of keeping us in our place, assign you to the role of repressing any of our malcontent, assign you to the role of doing all the things that we're saying that they're doing and going overboard and doing it at the same time, they're telling other countries that they got a real terrible human rights record, while ain't nobody even questioning them about what they're doing with us right here in their home. Then, you know, they're in a catch-22 position, man. If they go against that, they get moved on. The whole country will move on them. You understand what I'm saying? And they can't even talk about this. That's why they can't address it. That's why when it comes to them, man, they're in a catch-22. We want to take a task now. Okay, we're going to do them a favor. We ain't going to even bring this heat down on you. We ain't going to get you moved on. No kind of way, politically or any other kind of way. We're going to take it outside because there is an international a body of people that sit there among themselves and talk about how people in this world should conduct themselves while they're calling themselves civilized people in civilized nations. And we'll see if you stay within the ranks of a civilized nation.
I think we have basically exhausted a lot of time. What I would like to do is invite both of you gent brothers, as well as Naji, back on. I'm doing this show again in 2 weeks, two Sundays from now, and I would like to know if you brothers would be available then, and we can make sure that Naji comes on so we can conclude this discussion of Black August, with your permission.
Of course.
Of course, Norman, we accept that. And we thank you, man, for even allowing us to, you know, address these issues as difficult as it is to make, you know, an address. Because this stuff is not easy to break down and explain. If you haven't been through it and it's not happening to you or anybody that you know, it's really difficult. So we're happy that we got professionals with legal minds who can go in and investigate this and then sort it all out and put it down in an organized manner. You know, and then take it to the right places so that it, the discussion can be held where it should be held. And only thing
okay.
we can do basically is report on it.
So we have something happening on two Sundays from now, which is August. I'm not in front of a calendar. Whatever, two Sundays, August, beg your pardon?
21st,
yeah, we will be back on the air with you. And hopefully we can get Naji on the line at the same time, and we can make a go of this. And I would like to thank both of you brothers for comrades for coming on Uhuru Radio, and thank you very much.
Right on. Thank you,
man.
Thank you. All them people that are commemorating Black August, too, all over the world.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
And you have been listening to Kumasi and Shaka, the Black August Organizing Committee. And I believe I would like to thank Nia Beans of Zimbabwe for teching today. And today.